Well, one of the things that happens a lot for me as the young adults pastor is I get to do a lot of weddings, which is very fun. And I get to be involved in people's relationships. And so there is a, I'm sure most of you have been to weddings. Some of you, I've done your wedding, at least one in here, right? The lies are here. So in a wedding, there's often a vow, usually, pretty much always. And it goes something like this, right? Do you promise to love and cherish her or him in sickness and in health, for richer, for poorer, for better, for worse, and forsaking all others, keep yourself only for her or him, so long as you both shall live? And the answer is, maybe, right? Could I have some more time? Yeah, exactly. If all's going as planned, the answer is, I do, right? And this is an important thing to say in a wedding ceremony, because what you're doing is you're giving this person the opportunity to make a decision. You're saying, do you agree to do this? And it's a public decision, it's a vocal decision, it's a balanced decision, right? It's not just the good, it's the good and the bad. And so you're setting before them an opportunity, and you're inviting them to say, I do. I decide to do everything you just said. So what we're talking about tonight is deciding to love. And this event that happens in a wedding is kind of the epitome of when you might decide to love. It's a formal declaration of such a decision. And yet, really all throughout our lives, we make little decisions like this all the time. Do I choose to love this person? Do I not? And what does that look like? What does it mean to love someone else? We're in the middle of a series we started several weeks ago called Epic Decisions. The church as a whole is doing a series that we call Epic, and we're looking through the whole Bible over the course of 9 months, trying to follow the main narrative thread that the scripture reveals. And so what we're doing here in this group is we're taking each chapter that we're looking at, each little piece of the story we're looking at on a Sunday morning, and we're highlighting one of the decisions that somebody made during that time and trying to understand it, trying to learn about why they made that decision, whether it's a good decision or a bad decision. And it's kind of nice because it's nice to study a story and a narrative, so you get to kind of try to get inside that person's head as they're making a decision. Somebody tall want to turn that off? Jack? Gracie? Nice work. Yeah, perfect. Thank you. So the decision we're looking at tonight... Ooh. That was an epic decision. All right. The iPad is okay. You all right, Chris? I think he's frozen, but... All right. We'll move on. So the decision we're looking at tonight is a decision... Last Sunday we talked about the story of Joseph. And Joseph was one of the sons of Jacob, and he got sent to Egypt as a slave, and a bunch of stuff happened. What we're looking at tonight is a decision that Joseph's brother Judah made. And it's a very concrete decision that he chose, but it's preceded by a whole bunch of decisions before that. And actually, as it turns out, this decision that Judah makes is the pivotal decision in the story of Joseph. And it's what allows the Joseph story to move forward. So, in order to understand that, we're going to be looking at a few previous decisions. Because all of the decisions we make, we've done this several times as we've looked at this, is we all walk into things with a past. We all walk into things with other stuff that carries into it. So, none of the decisions we make are isolated events. They're factors of decisions we've made in the past, people we've known, situations we've been in. So we're going to follow Judah's story through three different scenes, and then we're going to see this decision he makes. And the decision he makes ends up being this pivotal point. It's like a wedding decision. It changes everything in that moment. We don't make a lot of those decisions, but there are some. There are some times where you're faced with a pivotal decision. Do I love this person? And if so, in what way? But we always make the little decisions. And as we're going to see, it ends up being really similar. Judah's decision is actually bookended. The decision he makes at the end is the decision that we like. It's the good decision, the decision to love. But it's preceded by the opposite decision. And we're going to see how that plays out. So I'm going to start off. What happens if you're here on Sunday, you heard a little bit of this story, but Joseph is the second youngest of 12 brothers. He has these dreams that his other brothers are going to serve him. And he tells his brothers about these dreams, which ends up not being the wisest thing to do. So they get mad at him, and he comes to meet them at one point. They see him from a long distance off, and they plot to kill him. So they grab him, they throw him in a pit. But at one point, Judah, one of his brothers, says this. Judah said to his brothers, this is Genesis 37, "What will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood." His brothers agreed. Now, Judah does say, "After all, he is our brother." But that's not actually the heart of his argument, right? What does he start with? What's his first point?
Let's make some money.
Yeah. Why would we kill him when we could sell him, right? Killing him doesn't get us anything. So the reason he wants to spare Joseph's life is not originally because he's my brother. It's because I don't get anything out of his death. But if I sell him, I got some cash in hand, right? So Judah makes this decision, convinces his brothers that selling Joseph is a better decision than killing him. And that's what they do. They sell Joseph to a band of traders who end up taking him off to Egypt to be a slave. Now, this is a classic case of complete self-centeredness, right? I mean, this is the definition of self-centered. Here's somebody else who happens to be your brother, and you choose to profit off of their misery, right? You get something, and that's exactly how Judah puts it. What do we gain if we kill him? We should do something to him that benefits us. We should make him suffer in a way that we get something out of it. And so what we're going to see is that this ends up being, in a sense, the exact opposite of what he'll do chapters later. But this is what we start off seeing, that Judah is willing to inflict suffering on Joseph so that he can gain something. Now, I think that being self-centered is probably our most natural state of being. I think that when we're born, we're inherently about us. The world revolves around us, our desires, our decisions. If you meet a baby, they're not thinking of you, right? And I know this with my kids, like, there's a reason why babies are small and weak, because if a hungry baby were big enough, it would rip your arms off to get food. I've had babies, and they will do anything to eat, and you cannot stand in their way. So it's good that they're like this big, right? Now, it's interesting for this community, because I think one of the things that is unique about the stage of life that a lot of you guys are in, we call this the Young Adult Fellowship. And one of the things that's unique about this stage of life is, in some ways, it tends to be inherently self-centered as well. Now, that's not to say that you are all self-centered, but this stage of life, I think, promotes a kind of self-centeredness. Because, by and large, you don't have outside obligations to other people, maybe to your family. Some of you are married, and that means that you do have an obligation to at least one other person. But by and large, it's about you and your job and figuring out where you want to live. And it's this very kind of self-centered time of life that's fairly rare. You know, when you grow up as in childhood, you're mostly under somebody else. You're in the context of a family. There's other people. If and when you get married and have a family, there's other people that you're responsible for and responsible to. But there's the season in the middle for a lot of people. College, if you go to college, and young adulthood, where you're kind of on your own. And everything really is about you. And I think that has some dangers that are good to be aware of. That in this season, it's, I think, easier to be focused on yourself. And so perhaps it's worth looking for other opportunities to extend outside of being self-centered. I was going to use as an example, I have a 8-year-old son, and one of the things we like to do together is play Yahtzee. Let's play Yahtzee. I remember actually playing Yahtzee with my dad, so it's really cool to like play Yahtzee with my son. But we were playing Yahtzee the other day, and you know, I rolled, you have three rolls, and a Yahtzee is when you get five rolls of the same number. So I rolled, and I think I got three, and I rolled again, and I got one more, so I had four of the same number, and I had one roll left, and I rolled for Yahtzee, and I didn't get it. And my son said, "Yes!" And I said, "Well, that's interesting." He's cheering so passionately for my failure. And it just made me realize. Now, what happened, though, was that he started destroying me in the game, right? So there was no way I could have won. And then his cheering changed, right? Once it was clear that he was going to win, he started going, "Oh, come on, get that full house. You know, come on, Daddy, you can do it." Because the game wasn't on the line anymore. So he's willing to cheer for me as long as it didn't threaten his victory, right? And I thought, you know, that's kind of how we are, right? I mean, we want to win. We want it to be about us. And maybe we'll want the other guy to do well as long as we can do better, right? And he's 8 years old, and, you know, it's kind of like, well, who do I have to blame but me for teaching him to compete like this? So this first scene we see of Judah then is the epitome of self-centeredness. Joseph suffers, Judah gains from it. Okay, that's our first scene. The next scene is really interesting. This whole section, Genesis 37 to 50, is mostly about Joseph, except for one chapter in the middle. Chapter 38 of Genesis is this side story, and it's about Judah and the children that he has and something that happens to him. It's a little bit curiously placed, but I think it's there because something happens to Judah that changes him and that helps to grow him so that he can make a different decision when it's necessary further on. So what happens is Judah has three sons. Judah marries a woman, has three sons, and his oldest son marries a woman. Her name is Tamar, right? His oldest son dies, and in that tradition, what happened was the next son in line was responsible for marrying that woman and having children for the sake of his brother. Those children would not be his children, they would be his brother's children because it was his brother's wife. Kind of complicated, but that's the way it worked. So Judah's oldest son died, so he married off his second son to this woman, Tamar. The second son died. So Judah thought, maybe this woman, Tamar, isn't great luck, right? So he thought, I don't know if I want to give her my last son. Because what if he dies too? So he withholds from her his last son. And she figures it out that he's plenty old enough to marry and she's not going to get him. So she dresses up as a prostitute and meets Judah coming back from the road and gets Judah to sleep with her. Isn't the Bible great? These stories are just like so great. So Tamar is dressed up as a prostitute, gets Judah to sleep with her. She becomes pregnant by Judah and gets Judah to give her his staff and signet ring, his cord, as guarantee that he's going to pay her. Months later, finds out, you know, she's got a belly and everybody gets mad. Hey, you're a widow. What are you doing pregnant? You slept with somebody. They're about to kill her. And she says, well, the baby belongs to the man who owns this signet ring. And of course, it's Judah's signet ring. Now, at this point, Judah has a couple of options, right? He could be really mad. He's just been found out. He's been exposed by this woman, Tamar. Now, he was in the wrong originally because he didn't let her marry his youngest son. But he could have done a lot of things. But this is what he does. Listen to Genesis 38. This is verse 24. About 3 months later, Judah was told, "Your daughter-in-law Tamar is guilty of prostitution, and as a result, she is now pregnant." Judah said, "Bring her out and have her burned to death." Nice guy, right? As she was being brought out, she sent a message to her father-in-law. "I am pregnant by the man who owns these," she said. And she added, "See if you recognize whose seal and cord and staff these are, just by chance," right? Judah recognized them. And here's the pivotal moment. And said, "She is more righteous than I, since I wouldn't give her to my son Shelah." And he did not sleep with her again. Now, what happens for Judah is that he has been confronted by his mistake, and he accepts it. And this is pretty remarkable. I mean, like, 10 words before, he was going to burn her to death, right? He gets exposed by her. Everybody knows that he slept with her. She made a fool of him. And what does he do? He says, she's right. I blew it. And he ends up raising this child. And this is important for Judah because this is his turning moment. This is where he is changed. And I think this is where he grows up, at least in the course of the narrative that is told in Genesis. He grows up and stops being self-centered because he's been exposed, because he did something so grievous that it changed him. And I think sometimes this is what happens to us. Sometimes this is what we need. Sometimes we need something to just shock us out of what we're doing, to just slap us in the face and say, don't you see? Don't you see what you're doing? Don't you see what kind of person you are? And we have an opportunity to choose how to respond when that happens. We can continue denying it. We can hide what's true of ourselves. We can fight being exposed, or we can allow ourselves to be changed. We can allow ourselves to snap out of it, to see what's really true. And that's what Judah ends up doing. So the next scene is where we start to see the good stuff. So this little picture of Judah and Tamar, I think, is written to show Judah's turnaround. And then what happens next, the story goes back to Joseph. And Joseph is sent to Egypt. And if you're there on Sunday, you know the whole story. Maybe you know the story anyway, but he ends up being thrown in jail for something he doesn't do in Egypt. He ends up being risen to the authority of the second in command of Egypt. And he's distributing food to people from all over that are coming to him because Egypt's, the whole world is in the midst of a famine. So eventually his brothers come to him. And there's these funny scenes where his brothers come to Joseph and have spent several years and now is dressed like an Egyptian and he's speaking Egyptian, not Hebrew. And so they don't recognize him. Why would they think that this man, who's the second in charge of Egypt, would be their long-lost brother that they tried to sell? So he kind of toys with them a little bit. And so he asks, how many brothers are there? First, only 10 brothers come. The youngest brother, Benjamin, which is Joseph's full brother, the others are all half-brothers. They don't bring him along because their father, Jacob, loved Joseph and loved Benjamin specially. So when Joseph was lost, Benjamin became kind of, you know, helicopter parenting, right? First case of biblical helicopter parenting. So Jacob was protecting Benjamin. So he sent the other 10 to Egypt. And Joseph recognizes, where is your brother? So he kind of asks them, hey, how many brothers do you have? And they tell him, we've got one more. So he says, go away. And he keeps one of the brothers and says, come back with Benjamin. I want to meet your other brother. So they go away with food. And Jacob says, sorry, I'm not sending Benjamin. So the other brother ends up staying in Egypt. Finally, though, they get hungry enough, they eat all the food he gave them the first time, that they have to go back and get more. And they know that they can't go back to Joseph without Benjamin with them, right? Joseph will not give them any more food because he told them, you're supposed to come right back with your other brother, and they didn't do it. So there's this discussion. What are we going to do? And at one point, Reuben, one of the other brothers, offers himself and says, I will be a guarantee for Benjamin's safety. And Jacob says, no, I'm not buying it. But then Judah steps up. And listen to what Judah says in Genesis 43. This is 8 to 9. Judah said to Israel, or Jacob, his father, send the boy along with me, and we will go at once, so that we and you and our children may live and not die. I myself will guarantee his safety. You can hold me personally responsible for him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him here before you, I will bear the blame before you all my life. As it is, if we'd not delayed, we could have gone back twice. I like that little zinger. So what does Judah do? He essentially says, I'll be responsible. And what he says is, you can hold my life in return for Benjamin's life. Now, this is a big change, right? I mean, if you had 12 kids and one of them sold the other into slavery, and then several years later said, hey, trust me with the other one you love. You'd probably say, well, no thanks. Yeah, no. But Judas changed. And so what he does here is he risks himself for the sake of Benjamin. He says, put my life on the line for the sake of my brother. And this is the first thing we want to think about, that the first step in deciding to love is risk. To risk something of yourself. And what we're going to see in the next stage is that that risk becomes even riskier. But this first step that Judah does is to risk something. And that's important because any kind of love for anyone else involves that first step of risk, of opening yourself up, of risking rejection. If you're going to ask somebody out, that's a risk. You're risking rejection. If you're going to ask someone to marry you, that's a risk. You're risking a whole lot. If you're driving along the highway and you see somebody who stopped and they look like they're in trouble and you stop to help them, that's a risk. You're risking maybe your own safety. Maybe you're risking that they'll say, get away, I don't want any help. And you feel bad all day because somebody yelled at you and you tried to help. Any decision, I would feel bad all day. Any decision to love is a risk. You're putting yourself in some risk. We're going to talk about this more in a minute, but that's not usually the way we think of love in our culture. This is where our culture gets love wrong. Our culture thinks of love as receiving, as being a beneficiary of something. But love begins with what Jude is doing here. It begins with risking of yourself. And I think that this is particularly hard sometimes for men because relational risk is a very different thing than other types of risk. So I've actually known people that are very, very, they have a very, low risk tolerance or high risk tolerance, right? They'll jump off cliffs, they'll drive fast, they'll ski in crazy places, but when it comes to risking something relationally, they're terrified, right? Because it's a very different thing to make a relational risk than it is to make a financial risk or a safety risk or those types of risks. And yet, if you're going to be in a relationship, if you're going to be in any type of relationship, friendship, family, romantic relationship, it has to start with risk. And sometimes that's hardest for guys. I don't know why. But guys, I think, can have an easy time of just kind of letting things keep going and kind of keeping the status quo. And yet, if you were here when we talked about male-female relationships earlier in the spring, I actually think it's the most important for the man to be willing to risk. Certainly in a romantic relationship, but also that's a skill to learn as a man. How do you risk in a relationship? How do you risk loving someone else? How do you open yourself up to someone? And marriage, as it turns out, we're going to come back to marriage a couple times as an example of this, although certainly this applies in any type of love relationship. Marriage is a huge relational risk. For a guy to get down on one knee and say, will you marry me? You have no idea what the next N number of years is going to hold. And you're inviting this person to be with you through it. It's a huge risk, but it's a worthwhile risk. And I think that a lot of guys are aware of that, which tends to be why a lot of guys are slower to get married, slower to date, slower sometimes. And yet, you don't get anything if you don't risk, right? And what we're going to see is when you do risk, then love happens, and it's an incredible thing. But Judas starts off by risking. He steps up, he's a leader, and he risks for the sake of his brother. And this is what happens next. They get to Egypt, and Joseph knows that Benjamin is special. So all the 11 brothers are there. He has them on this big banquet, feeds them a lot of food, fills their bags with food to go home, but he hides his special silver cup in Benjamin's bag. And as soon as they leave, he sends his police after them. They find them. They search all the bags, and they say, Benjamin was the thief. He stole this cup. So they all get hauled back to Egypt, and Joseph says, Benjamin, you stole my silver cup. I'm going to throw you in jail for the rest of your life. Kind of interesting decisions for Joseph to make here, but that's not the decision we're thinking about tonight. So what happens? Judah steps up. Remember, he'd already told his dad, if I don't come back with Benjamin, you can have my life in exchange. He'd already made the risk, and now he chooses the sacrifice. Listen to Genesis 44. I'm going to read a long section here. I'm going to read verses 18 to 34, and I want to read this long section because it's a lot of dialogue. And I think what you get is you get a sense of who Judah is now. And it's a very different Judah than we saw in the past. So bear with me as I read this. Genesis 44. Then Judah went up to him, that's Joseph, and said, please, my lord, let your servant speak a word to my lord. Do not be angry with your servant, though you are equal to Pharaoh himself. My lord asked his servants, do you have a father or a brother? And we answered, we have an aged father, and there is a young son born to him in his old age. His brother is dead, and he is the only one of his mother's sons left, and his father loves him. Then you said to your servants, bring him down to me so I can see him for myself. And we said to my lord, the boy cannot leave his father. If he leaves him, his father will die. But you told your servants, unless you, your youngest brother comes down with you, you will not see my face again. When we went back to your servant, my father, we told him what the Lord, what my lord had said. Then our father said, go back and buy a little more food. But we said, we cannot go down. Only if our youngest brother is with us will we go. We cannot see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us. Your servant, my father, said to us, you know that my wife bore me two sons. One of them went away from me, and I said, he has surely been torn to pieces, and I have not seen him since. If you take this one from me too, and harm comes to him, you will bring misery. You will bring my gray head down to the grave in misery. So now if the boy is not with us when I go back to your servant, my father, and if my father, whose life is closely bound up with the boy's life, sees that the boy isn't there, he will die. Your servants will bring the gray head of our father down to the grave in sorrow. Your servant guaranteed the boy's safety to my father. I said, if I do not bring him back to you, I will bear the blame before you, my father, all my life. And here's the key decision. Now then, please let your servant remain here as my lord's slave in place of the boy, and let the boy return with his brothers. How can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? No. Do not let me see the misery that would come upon my father. And what I think is so remarkable about this speech is how much Judah understands his father. You notice so much of what he said is, my father feels this, my father said this, my father would be in sorrow. He loves his father now. He empathizes with him. And the thing that he tells him at the end, do not let me see the misery that would come upon my father. Notice he has guaranteed himself for the sake of his brother. He doesn't say, if I go back without him, I'm going to get a whooping. He's not concerned about himself. He says, if I go back, it'll kill my father. And I love my father too much to see that happen. So what does he do? He says, take me instead. Benjamin is guilty, but take me and punish me for his crimes. So what is that? It's the opposite of what he did at first, right? The first decision he made was to inflict misery on someone else for his own personal gain. Now he does the opposite. He accepts misery on himself for the gain of another. He loves his father. He loves Benjamin, and he acts. And this is the decision. This ends up being the turning point in the whole story, because after this, chapter 45, verse 1, then Joseph could no longer control himself, and he starts weeping, and he reveals himself to his brothers. Why then? I think because he realized that they changed, that Judah was a different Judah, that before he chose the anti-love decision, but now he chose the decision to love. And this ends up being, if I say this fairly regularly, so if you've been around, you've probably heard me say this. This is my definition of love. Being willing to suffer for the sake of someone else. That's what love is. Being willing to take on personal suffering for the sake of someone else's gain. Now, I alluded to this before. Think about how our culture defines love. I fell in love with someone. What do you mean when you say that? You usually mean they make me feel really, really, really good, right? That's usually what we mean. Now, I would call that attraction. And it's not bad. It's not wrong. But it's not love. Our culture thinks of attraction, that I'm attracted to this person. Why? Because they make me feel good. And that's natural. That's why we have friends. That's why we click with certain people, because there's chemistry and we have common interests or something. That's attraction. And it happens in friendships and in families. You're attracted more to some members of your family than others, and you're attracted to someone romantically and you come together with them. But that's not love. Love is when you're willing not to feel good because they're with you, but to sacrifice something of yours for the sake of making them feel good. Love is a decision you make for their sake. It's not the way they make you feel. So, the nature of love is to give yourself up for the sake of another. Now, it's helpful, though, in talking about this, to give a little bit of a caveat. Because there are some times, and this happens with Christians fairly often, when you can get into a situation where you give too much of yourself up. So I want to make a little bit of a distinction. You can't see it because I'm reading this, but in my notes I have, there's a difference between giving yourself up, which is my definition of love, and giving your space self up. And at times I've seen people that give up their sense of self, their identity, their volition to another person. And that's not love. That's oppression. That's domination. That turns into often abusive relationships. And sometimes those things can be confusing. I've sometimes heard Christians say, well, I just need to give myself up more for this person. And I know the relationship, and I know, actually know, that they've given up their identity to them. And that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about making a choice for the sake of another, not handing over your selfhood to them. Does that make sense a little bit? Okay. So Judah makes this decision then to love, and what it does is it turns the whole story. Because of this, Joseph reveals himself to his brothers. He invites the father to come to Egypt, and he starts off a whole new chapter in their story. Now, this also becomes significant in a biblical sense, in the sense of the whole story, because this decision that Judah makes to love, essentially he says, here is someone who's guilty, but don't punish him, punish me for his sake. And that decision, that willingness, becomes the model then that God uses to save all of us. So God sends his own son, sends Jesus, and that's the decision that Jesus makes, the ultimate love. Jesus will say, greater love has no one than this, that he give up his life for his friends. And that's what he does. He does the same thing Judah does. He makes the same decision. He says, even though they are guilty and I am not, take my life in return. And that's what opens up life for us, to live a reconciled relationship to God, to know him, and then to see that model and to learn to love others. So there's a lot of ways that this plays out. I wanted to talk a little bit more about it, but we're going to wrap up now. There's a whole lot of things that you sacrifice to love another person. In the context of romantic relationships, men often have to learn to sacrifice a sense of, how would we say?
Manliness?
Manliness sometimes, sure. Predictability, control. Men like often to understand what's going on, and in a relationship you can't always understand what's going on, and yet you have to give that up sometimes to love someone else. Emotional simplicity is often lost. Women sometimes have to give up in romantic relationships this idea of the perfect man. My wife didn't have to give that up. Most women have to give up this. Just kidding. Most women have to give up this. You know, there's kind of a romantic image in the world of the shining knight on the white horse, and few of us men are like that. And that's a hard thing to say. All right, none of us are like that. Don't hold out hope. Don't just say. There are no men like that, women. All right, if you're looking for them, stop. And you know, as you start, what happens is you learn to love. You decide to love. And you're faced with more and more decisions to do the same. You decide to love another person to get married, and you decide to walk through those things. And then you have children, and you realize that you have to keep deciding to sacrifice yourself for the sake of another. I am so glad my children are done waking up in the middle of the night, because that, to wake up and be groggy and have to take care of a screaming child, was the definition of love for me. And it was not attraction. I felt no attraction toward this child. Pure sacrifice for the sake of another. And so the path that I see God doing in a lot of our lives, and I really understand this to be the path of maturity, of growth, is learning to love. Learning to decide to love. Romance is part of it. Friendship is part of it. Family is part of it. But this is what God is doing in us if we know him. Teaching us to make decisions for the sake of another person that cost us. And the good news is that there's something beautiful that happens when you do that. For Judah, when he did that, Joseph revealed himself. The family was reunited. It was amazing. So on the other side of this kind of love is really something that's far more powerful than two people that are just attracted to each other. So it's worthwhile.